Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Canadian-based vocalist, guitarist, and producer Jessica Storr. She talked about her new 2022 CD, The Joan Becco Legacy Project. Not all remarkable creators get the spotlight they deserve during their lifetime, and this Joan project came into existence to produce that debut, even though she's not around. It profiles a prolific, brilliant, and under-celebrated female Jewish Canadian composer that passed away at the age of 88 in January of 2021. When this Vancouver-based musician moved to Toronto, quitting work as a vintage clothes buyer for a career in music, her goals were very simple: release an album of original songs, hear her music on the radio, and satisfy her wanderlust on tour around the world. She is well on her way to doing just that. Enjoy this interview.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
It's wonderful. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
So, exactly. Thank you for, and I'm going to get to a first here talking about Joan and her work and you covering
yeah.
it. So, first and foremost, I want to know, before we get to this project, you know, we went through quite a time on planet Earth. It's good that mm-hmm. artists are now out playing and doing mm-hmm. things they weren't doing for a couple of years. How did you survive COVID and how did that time change you?
Well, I'm pretty good at pivoting. I'm a person who when limitations come up, I often look and say, well, okay, what it is possible within these new limitations? And so first off, I actually took a little bit of time off because I'm a bit of a workaholic and I've been a professional musician for 15 years. And so I've been kind of at it very hard. And so first thing I did was took a little bit of time off and it was really wonderful. And it sort of helped me imagine maybe how I would like life and work to return to inject some of that time off. And so that's sort of an important thing. For me, that happened. But aside from that, I was working on, I'm an artist in and of myself, and I recently, during the pandemic, actually put out an album under a new indie pop artist moniker, Jessa. And so I had received some funding from one of the government agencies here called Factor, and part of it was to create video content. They increased the amount of funding because of the pandemic, and they recognized that while live performance wasn't possible, that, you know, consumption of music online was more important than ever. And so I actually came up with a bunch of concepts and executed a whole bunch of really cool music videos, and I released them throughout the pandemic. I also recorded some live performance videos and released those. And so that's what I did for a lot of the time. But the absence of performing, you know, I used to play sort of 200 gigs a year type thing and tour quite a lot. And obviously that completely changed, which is such a big adjustment. And my mother, Wendy Bross Stewart, who co-music directed the Joan Becco Legacy Project with me, she also is quite a busy, active musician in the Vancouver music scene. And I had had a vision for this Joan Becco Legacy Project for many years, from before Joan had passed and we had gotten her permission to do it. And she passed in early 2021. And because it was during the pandemic, even though she's based in Vancouver and I'm based in Toronto, there was a Zoom memorial. And during that time, it became clear to me that it was time to move on this project and that the space created by the absence of live performance in my life and my schedule and my mother's would make this really the best time to do it. And so we put in some grant applications for the project and we received. And therefore, we got started. And so the last 14 months have been all about the Joan Becco Legacy Project. I mean, I'm still working as a side person. I also produce other people's records too. And I also, you know, write my own music and have my own different music series and things. However, my full-time focus has been the music of Joan Becco and this project and how to connect it to the ears of the world. That's what's been going on.
So she passed away at the age of 88 in January of 2021. What
Correct.
Was her knowledge of this project and what you were doing?
Well, Joan and my mother, Wendy, were 40-plus year collaborators. My mother was an arranger for her, edited her work. They worked together on creating pieces. And then my mother funneled her pieces, was kind of Joan's main champion, and funneled her pieces, Joan's music, through to whatever ensembles, groups, schools, choirs, that my mother was involved with. So she was one of the main outputs. So Jones would write this music and work on it with my mother, and then my mother would get it performed live so that it would hit the stage. And so that had been going on for a long time, and within the past 10 years, Joan's health started going downhill, and also, you know, she started losing some of her sharpness, and so she ended up, you know, relocating to an elder care home in Vancouver. And so I visited her there anytime I was in Vancouver, because she was quite important to me and my family, and my mother would visit her as well. And so the last time that we saw her, which was in 2019, we asked her permission to do this project, and her exact words were, I can think of no one better. And so that she consented to the project and gave us her blessing. And, it's just, you know, the one sad thing about it all is how close she came to being able to hear the stir that her music has evoked in these musicians who have just recorded it, and the way that her music is impacting the world around, the ripples of it now that it's coming out. And I just wish that she had been alive to be able to enjoy that, because she missed out. She missed out on the whole thing in her, you know, humble and modest kind of approach to music. So I'm trying to fix that. That's the whole point of this, is I want her music to live on long past my mother's life, Joan's life, my life. I want it to become part of the canon, because it's that good.
So it seems like she's an unfortunate part of that male-dominated world that happened for so long. You hear about this with a lot of female musicians, and is this kind of by proxy kind of a product of that, like bringing the recognition that she should have already gotten anyway?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I had ideas before. That's definitely a hot topic right now in the media, and, you know, on people's minds and on their tongues, is definitely kind of trying to spotlight on the under-celebrated and those who have kind of slipped through the cracks. So that's definitely, it's definitely a good time for this album to be coming out because of that. But the truth is that, like, the reason that this project idea started is because, like, growing up in this environment where her music was so pervasive, and also in all these groups my mother led, her music was being performed, I actually thought that Joan was a celebrity. And I thought that she was famous and her music was well known. And so it was only when I auditioned with one of her pieces for a choral position in Toronto in 2016 that the person I was auditioning for and the accompanist, they were like, when I finished performing, they just were like transfixed by this music. They were staring at the chart. They said, where can we find this? Is this person Canadian? We're always looking for more Canadian content. And she was born in the States, in Chicago, but she lived for the last 50 years or so in Canada as an I guess as she emigrated or as a Canadian citizen. And so, you know, I told them, oh, you haven't heard of her? Oh, well, you must not have been looking very hard, because she's famous. She's a famous Canadian composer in the choral world. And so then later that night, I consulted with my mother to ask her where I could send them to get her pieces, and found out that literally none of her music existed online, and that no one could access it without purchasing sheet music directly from my mother, who had published it in her own company. So this was the thing which actually, it shook me, because this music is so formative in my life as a composer, and it is so good and unusual and different. It really has its own character, yet it draws from the classic kind of themes and motifs, yet it feels different. It got this amazing juxtaposition of the feeling of familiarity and the feeling of something new and unexpected happening at the same time. And so anyway, I knew that I needed the world, like I wanted more people to hear it, and I was pretty convinced that objectively it was good, but I had to get some friends to tell me in the music scene. I started sharing, you know, my mother's recordings of my mother playing the piano parts and me singing, you know, sometimes great, sometimes well and sometimes not so well to these beautiful pieces, and sharing them with my cohort and my colleagues. And they were all very moved by the music. And that's when I knew that it objectively was special, not just because of my raising. So that's really the inspiration for the project, is I recognized that this woman's work, her whole life's work, was never celebrated in the way that it deserves. And that's one of actually my kind of stances in the music community here, at least, is that I recognize that success and ingenuity are not necessarily correlated, and that skill and creativity and that some of the most amazing work never gets any success, and that it's not because the work isn't good, it's because of the way that, you know, everything works. And so it's one of my goals in my career as a musician and as a member of the music community of North America, Canada, Toronto. It's one of my goals to be able to try to shine spotlights on people and music and artists who are doing things worth note, even if they're not known and they aren't a media darling.
So talk to me about your roots. You know, how did you get involved with music? Did you always know that you were going to be a musician?
Well, I mean, my mother's an incredible musician. She's a classically trained performance pianist. She's an incredible music director, and she's an ethnomusicologist. So I grew up steeped in music and have been, you know, singing and playing and dancing and performing in little old folks' homes or our living rooms since I was an infant, basically. So that was sort of in my blood. I think when I picked up guitar for the first time after hearing Led Zeppelin and Heart as a teenager, I think that that was the first time that I felt a different connection to music. Like, this was my connection point, which wasn't the same as my mother's to music, and I kind of started finding my alley. And so I think I had aspirations of doing music, but took a little diversion, went to linguistics in university, like studied linguistics in university for a bit, ended up managing and buying for a vintage clothing store and traveling around doing that for several years. And then all of a sudden, you know, 15 years ago, I realized that it was time to pursue my own dreams and stop living these other things. And so I came here and did it. But, you know, I'm an instrumentalist, a guitar player, lots of electric. I get hired to play in lots of people's rock and funky and soulful kind of bands. And I also play the Japanese koto, which is a direct influence from my mother and then also from living in Japan as a child. And so that's the 13-string zither. And so I write music with both those instruments, and I'm a vocalist. And so I do all those things. And then, you know, I'm in the past 10, 15 years, I've really developed as a composer and an arranger. And I end up in music direction scenarios quite a lot. And then I'm newly producing records. So that is my, and having a fantastic time at it, pulling together all of the different skills and, you know, both musical and also with people that I've acquired during my life and also my career in music. So that's sort of where I'm at.
Wow, that's amazing. I just had a thought when you said zither. When I was in the eighth grade, there was like this trivia question, and they asked everybody what they thought a zither was. And people were like, is it a new candy bar? Is it a dream? You know, no one could figure it out. But I was with this one guy. His name was Jeff Klein, and we would always see each other and say zither. It was just like a joke. Because no one could figure it out. We were just like, it's an instrument? And then we saw it, we were like, wow, that's amazing. So anyway, it's just when you said zither, all of the light bulbs from my junior high years went off.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that with me. It's amazing. Sometimes these things just come around. It's just, they have this meaning assigned. You can't shake it. But yeah, for sure.
The world is just an enormous turnstile. We're just all making our way through with our own way. So it's crazy.
I like that.
What was the very first show that you ever saw that blew you away? First live show.
You know what's funny is I just was talking about this weekend with my partner. This just came up. And actually, the first show that I saw that really blew me away was in 1997. It was Jamiroquai live in Vancouver. It was 10-piece band. It was 10-piece band. It was the first time that I had seen, like, I'd seen a lot of classical music, and I'd been to musicals and all the stuff with my parents. I'd seen, you know, chamber music, and I'd seen kind of world music stuff. But I was just sort of new to, like, going to rock concerts. You know, for a couple of years I'd been going and seeing big stadium stuff, and then also going to punk rock shows. And so seeing Jamiroquai was the first time that I heard musically skilled people playing groovy, funky, not uptight music, if you know what I mean. You know?
Yeah.
And that it sounded amazing, because the venue wasn't huge, but it was like, you know, I think it was like a couple thousand. But just what I remember is how tight everyone was. There was no music stands. All the horn section was playing, having a fun time. They're all dancing. They're perfectly in sync. And it was just like this amazing thing. And so that was actually the first concert that really affected me. And I think the truth is that when I first moved to Toronto to do music, I think I kind of wanted to be in like a Jamiroquai-like funky jazzy band. I think that's what I wanted my original, my project to be. And I think I kind of wrote like that briefly until I kind of figured out what my voice was. And that factors into a part of, you know, my aesthetic, but it's not, you know, that's his thing. So that's JK's thing from Jamiroquai. But anyway.
No, that's great. You know, I remember that at that time I was in my 20s, and my best friend who introduced me to jazz went to Germany to help build a hardwood floor for his brother, because I guess it's just crazy expensive to do it.
Wow.
And while he was there, he picked up all these pop culture notes, and he came back and he said, "This dude is on fire in Europe." And he played it, and we'd never really heard anything like that. And then all of a sudden, he's on MTV, he's all over the radio.
Right.
But I remember he brought that over from Europe and said, "We got to listen to this dude." And then he just
flew
off and took off. Yeah.
Wow. So well, that was the heydays for that band too, because like when they changed, there was like, I think the bass player changed after like within a few years of that, and then the music kind of went down a much more simple path. Very simple chord progressions, more sort of disco and house oriented rather than the kind of like dance floor jazz or acid jazz thing that was coming out of the 90s still, you know what I mean? So it kind of went in a different direction. So anyway, for me, that was the Jamiroquai heyday.
Yeah, and he was the only dude that could pull off that fuzzy slash top hat, you know?
Yeah,
you know.
So the other day when my partner and I talked about this, we, of course, went and looked for a concert from that same year online. And when it did a close-up on his face, my partner said, "Wow, he's not a very handsome dude, is he?" And then I said, "Well, maybe that's why he wears the hat."
Uh-huh. Right, because he always had shades and a hat. He was doing it he had a reason, that's for sure. You know?
Maybe.
He was making that pumpkin look good. But So at the end of the day, you know, as a professional musician, what do you like the best about this process? What do you look forward to every day being a musician?
I really like having a lot of different ways to use different parts of my skills. So I really like the creating of music a lot. But I also like the kind of, it's a funny word to use, the orchestrating of everything, the making it happen. So not just the arrangements themselves, the actual orchestrations of doing things, but also just seeing like the idea that the fact that I can have an idea in my head that only exists in my head and that I can make it happen in real life and then it results in this physical result. That to me is very exciting about music and about creativity. So I really like that. Of course, I love playing music. In this project, I'm not doing much playing. I'm singing. I sang on some of the pieces, and I really enjoyed the ensemble work. I love singing in harmony with people and also just singing weird and wonderful music. And this is definitely some weird and wonderful music. And, of course, I would be remiss to not mention that working with my mother this past 14 months on this project has been incredible. This is definitely the first big project we've worked on together, and you never know how things are going to go with family, you know what I mean? But magically,
yeah.
Because of this, I have such a respect for my mother. I'm sure you already picked up on that from the things that I've said, but I just think, you know, she's such a powerhouse, and so was Joan, and so was one of the other matriarchs of our project who worked together with Joan and my mother, Claire Osipov, who was an operatic soprano. I was raised, you know, with these women around all the time, and this example around me all the time, and it never occurred to me that I couldn't do anything because they were all doing it, you know? And so
yeah.
Getting to work with my mother now as an equal and also, you know, kind of be her boss for parts of this, because I am the director and the producer of the project, and she doesn't have the experience in her career about putting out records and what that entails. So, you know, I've been steering the ship there, and then also knowing when to fall back and let her lead in, you know, in the co-music direction capacity. And so that's been really fun. And then to see her work with all of my music community and my colleagues in Toronto for the first time, since she's based in Vancouver and I'm based here, we don't get to work together with each other's people that often. So watching that was, I just think it was a real joy for me to see the people whose work I respect so much from my scene getting to work with my mother, who I think is like just so incredible. And they all felt so as well. And so there's a lot of really, really wonderful elements of this project for me.
It almost seems like in a subconscious way that just adds another layer to this. It's like this had to be a comfort project because coming out of a pandemic, I think I'm noticing that there's been projects people are doing that are comforting, that are familiar,
right,
that are helping
right
out. So without maybe knowing it, obviously
maybe you're
up
right
front, you know, by proxy, it's almost a cathartic healing thing to do that, to get back into the world, the phoenix rising, so to speak.
I think you might be right. I definitely resonates as something with some truth to it. But also, like, I just think, I think maybe our timing is good to make interest for this project. Maybe if this, I had executed this project when I, you know, in 2016, when I first found out that Joan's work wasn't known widespread, then maybe it would have been too early also for the world to kind of do the appropriate things with it. So I do feel like now that everyone's been staring at their screens the last 2 years, and in that world, there's some things have sort of shifted and evolved, I think. And definitely, it feels like the right time for this project to come out. So I'm very happy about that because you can't plan those sorts of things. I mean, you know, my own art, Jessa album that I put out during the pandemic was like the worst timed thing because it basically happened and was not acknowledged at all. And to no one's fault, there's just so much news on that they were only, you know, putting 40% of the amount of music into the library at each station that they usually would. And so, you know, it was bad timing, but maybe this is perfect timing. And so maybe that's good enough.
You know, it's weird. I do you like the movie Donnie Darko?
I saw it, but I actually don't remember it. I know what's on the soundtrack, though. I mean, some of the stuff on the soundtrack, I remember that there's
yeah
the Tears for Fears song. Yes.
Yeah, so so it's kind of a cold underground thing. It's a wonderful film. But I always wondered why it tanked. And it tanked because it was released in October of 2001, right after 9/11. And no one was
right
ready for it. You know, all
exactly
of that frivolity. We got to a very serious moment in history. So anyways, it's funny how things work. You don't know what's going to happen. You just got to go with it. But so
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, when you peel back the onion layers of history, it's weird how it works. In fact, real quick piece of trivia for you that I don't know if you remember that New York Mets 1986 World Series game where the ball went underneath Billy Buckner's legs.
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay. Well, it was one of the biggest mistakes in the history of baseball, and he wasn't supposed to be in the game. They only put him in the game because it was kind of a ceremonial thing because he played first base all the time. But they historically would pull him out in the sixth inning because at that point in his career, his knees hurt so bad. But they just
oh
happened to put him in, and it created the biggest blunder in the history
oh
of baseball. Yeah. So when you start looking at things, yeah, it's weird how history works. But
it really is
of history. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just like, and you don't realize it at the time. You just take it for face value.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
But if you look, there is a story to each occurrence. Everything that happens is you could make a timeline of its history and how that
yeah
moment came to be. There could be
yeah
that for sure. Yeah, that's interesting
yeah
for sure.
It's wild. So speaking of history and time, if you could go back in time and see any jazz show live, where would you go? Who would you see?
That's a good question. I think I need a moment to contemplate that. Just recently, I watched the 12-hour Ken Burns series on jazz. So part of me is like, thinks going back to the kind of earlier times, like the 30s and earlier kind of times of whatever was going on, just seeing you know, jazz when it was sort of popular music, that would have been really interesting, as opposed to, I guess, the question was sort of more about specific jazz musicians. Yeah, I'm not quite sure in this moment, because actually, you know, what comes to mind also is that I'm a really big fan of the Dave Holland Quintet, but I've seen them. It's not fair to say that.
Well, I like that. That's a great answer. You did that. This can be a period thing too. It doesn't need to be specific honed in onto one thing. That's a great answer. It's very unique. I've never heard it before.
I mean, it would just be amazing. Like, you know, right now jazz is so niche, and it shouldn't be. I don't really think it's people's fault entirely. It's partly the fault of gatekeepers, I think, and, you know, people assuming that their audience is dumber than they are, or maybe has a less of a appetite or capacity for music. And so everything's so dumbed down now in popular music that it seems like a stretch that those people could enjoy jazz. But, I mean, the truth is that I think that if it were packaged in a different way, and when it is packaged in a different way, that it does end up with a wide listenership. So the idea of going when that was the hot music, that was the popular music, and seeing, and people would go dancing, and people would, you know, really enjoy the live thing, that would be an amazing thing to be a part of.
Everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. You have a perception of yourself. Who do you think you are?
Oh, goodness me. I am someone who... I feel like I'm a little bit of a contradiction. I like things to be different and to be changing all the time. Yet there's certain things that I like to be stable and remain the same as comfort. I am very driven and accomplishing. Doing that thing I was talking to you about, where an idea just from your head becomes an actual tangible thing, that it could just be an event that moves physical bodies into a room, meaning putting on a show, for instance, that used to just be an idea in my head, and I have this idea, I make an event for it, I hire some people, and all of a sudden, hundreds of bodies change the course of their evening to get the place that I wanted to do it. So that all makes me very excited. I also have a very high and very low opinion of myself at the same time. I think I'm capable of a lot, and I recognize my skills, my varied skills, but at the same time, I feel like there's a lot I could really do better at and that I'm terrible at. So I don't know. I think I'm a bit of an in-betweener. I've always felt a little bit like I didn't belong, and maybe this has something to do with the fact that, you know, growing up with New York Jewish parents in West Coast Canada, maybe my directness was always different than the people around me, and maybe when I lived in Japan as a child, being the only non-Japanese person in that entire school, or in that town to ever go to that school, and then coming back and then being ostracized because of my experience in Japan and so on and so forth. And so I just feel like I've always felt like a bit of an outsider, but I know how to float in a lot of different pools. Maybe that's kind of who I am.
That's a great answer. I like it. Jessica, thank you for opening up about the project, about your life and music. This has been wonderful. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your support. Have a really fantastic evening, afternoon.
You too. Absolutely. You too. Cheers.
Okay.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and singers in Toronto, Vancouver, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Jessica for her time, energy, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit neonjazz@youtube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends. I want to tip you off to a wonderful program I found out about. As we expand our reach, we have made some friends out there in the world that love jazz as much as we do. This program is fully endorsed by Neon Jazz.
Gerald Albright, Rhea Snyder, Charlie Hunter, Duke Robillard, Sean Jones, Walter Beasley, Steve Swallow. Something Came from Baltimore is a jazz, blues, and R&B podcast and radio show, and it's not really about Baltimore. Subscribe to the podcast and listen to your favorite artist or future favorite artist. That's Something Came from Baltimore. And be a part of that Be More Music scene. Joe Lovano, Jeff Kaufman, Paula Cole, Danuzo Makatani, Ann Passio, Chess Smith, Thumbscrew.
Neon Jazz.